First thing I'd like to do is acknowledge my co-authors, and there's quite a lengthy list of those guys on here, some of them in the room, some of them not. Dr. Mitchell, who's with the USDA ARS there in Lincoln, as well as Marty Schmier and Virginia Lynn, who are in a different research unit. Mary Drunowski and Jay Parsons, who are actually part of the cluster hire that I was in, hired into at the University of Nebraska. And also Umberto Blanco, who also participates on this project. So that I tell you that it takes a lot of people to pull off some of these system studies. And there's an awful lot of gaps that still exist, even though there are a lot of people that participate in these. About 10 or 11 years ago, there was another symposium here at the annual meetings with a similar title to the one I have. Mark Schultz and Ben Tracy presented a talk on that, and I pulled out a couple of sentences directly out of the proceedings, or the symposium proceedings that was published following that. And both those guys stated that a critical need exists for funding and development of multidisciplinary teams dedicated to systems-level research on integrated crop livestock production. That need is still there today, although I do think there is some movement in that direction. Secondarily, they stated there's also a need for education and training of agricultural advisors and producers on how to develop and manage integrated crop livestock systems. If you noticed in that picture in the background, I'm kind of standing back there with my hand on my chin. In the foreground is Mary Drunowski. She's standing there with her hand on her chin. The guy to the right of that photograph is Tyler Berkey, who's a producer that had us out. And I don't remember what question that he asked us, but it must have been awful perplexing. So, and he's actually giving a talk in a couple of weeks in our Center for Grassland Studies seminar series on managing integrated cow-calf production systems for a new generation. And I think those last two words are critical as we start to think about the development of some of these systems, although it's maybe not a new generation. Monty, it may be a regeneration. So hopefully we're moving in that direction. Some of the things that I want to talk about today a little bit are some of the background and issues that we deal with in the Midwest in corn and beef systems. Looking specifically at integrated crop livestock systems, I think the two areas that we're focusing on primarily, at least in Nebraska, are managing crop residue and also looking at grazed cover crops as a potential for improving some of our beef production systems. Also want to address a little bit on marginal lands, because I think that's an area that maybe needs to be re-emphasized, and we need to look at moving in, increasing some of the forage production and potentially beef production in some of those areas as well. If I have time toward the end, I'll tell you a little bit about a model system that we put together to try to look at some of the management scenarios that are critical for these systems, and then give you some of my final thoughts and a summary. Typically, when we look at forage beef systems, one of the things that is pretty common is that most of the cow-calf production occurs on perennial forage. In Nebraska, we're blessed with quite a bit of native rangeland that most of our cow-calf production occurs on. In other parts of the U.S., the perennial pastures are where a lot of the grazing occurs. Typically what happens then with the stocker production is where it varies a lot by region. In Nebraska, we have quite a number of feedlots available, so a lot of our calves as they're weaned can move into the feedlot. Oftentimes some of them move to crop residue that can be moved to improved pastures. Currently what we're looking at some is moving those to annual forages or grazed cover crops prior to going to the feedlot. So we have an awful lot of opportunity in Nebraska and throughout the Midwest to look at developing some, I don't know that they're unique systems, but they're pretty fairly straightforward and can often be pretty profitable. Some of the issues that we have, and Vern, I don't think they gave us data for Canada, but I suspect a lot of those colors would blend up into Canada as well if we had that data. But back in the mid-2000s, one of the things that happened, there was a lot of perennial grasses were converted into row crops when grain prices increased. Also at that time, there was a reduction in livestock numbers. The reduction in livestock numbers continued to occur when we had the drought in 2010, 2011, 2012. What's happened since 2013, though, is corn prices have moderated, but corn input production costs have not. So what we have are a bunch of marginally productive lands, have high erosion potential, shallow soils per drainage, and limited crop productivity. But I would argue that other than that, they're pretty good. You guys are still asleep, right? Okay. So when we look at corn residue utilization, this is a paper that Marty Schmier put together early in the year, trying to get a handle on how we manage our corn residue in the U.S. And this shows the 19 top states, those dark blue, that includes Kansas, Nebraska, South Dakota, and Colorado. Those have greater than 20% of the land area of corn residue is utilized. The lightest color, which is up towards the northeast, has typically less than 5%. This gives a little different view of the same thing. If you look at the pie charts there, the bigger the pie, the more corn residue is harvested. Iowa has the largest amount of corn residue harvested. Nebraska is the one immediately to the left of it there, has a fair amount, followed by Minnesota and then also South Dakota. From a grazing standpoint, Nebraska has quite a large number of hectares of corn residue that are grazed. That's around 40% of our total corn acres. There are some other estimates that go as low as 20% of our corn acres that are utilized for grazing corn residue. By far and away, we're the largest or have the greatest number of corn residue acres grazed due to the large number of livestock that we have. From a harvesting standpoint, Iowa has the largest number of corn residue acres that are harvested. Principally, they have a cellulosic biofuel industry that they were trying to get started about that time, so that may have influenced that a little bit. Minnesota and Wisconsin also have a large number of acres of corn residue that's harvested. That's principally for bedding for their dairy industry. Although it does have a livestock use, it doesn't directly go to feeding like the grazing looks at. Jim McDonald, who I maybe neglected to mention in my previous acknowledgments on the first slide, he's done quite a bit of work with Distillers Grains, and they've summarized four studies potentially, where they've looked at feeding different levels of distillers grains and used that to predict average daily gain on corn residue. And one of the things that they found is somewhere around 0.8% to body weight to 0.9% to body weight, they can produce around a pound and a half of average daily gain. That's pretty economical compared to grazing a lot of our annual forages, a lot of our perennial forages, and then also when we look at grazing a lot of those cover crops. When we look at producing cover crops following a lot of the crop production that occurs in Nebraska, one of the things that makes that work, not sure I can make the pointer work. I'll just talk about it. How about that? Talk about this. One of the things that makes the cover crops work is that we have quite a number of different crops that we grow in Nebraska. Winter wheat, although it's not a large number of acres, it is pretty prevalent in some areas. Hybrid seed corn production is another one that we don't have a lot of data on, but it's used quite regularly for grazing cover crops. Corn silage is another one that Mary Drunowski has done a little bit of work in. I'm not going to talk much about that today. I think Dr. Blanco is going to talk about some of the cattle effects on grazing some corn silage in the symposium this afternoon. But when we look at these, we've got quite a bit of opportunity in some instances with additional growing degree days after harvesting these grain crops that we can produce a substantial amount of forage cover crops that we can look at grazing and adding some additional cattle gain on. When you look at soybean there down at the far right of that graph, corn's going to fall in about the same same situation. There's really not a lot of time to produce cover crops that you can graze into the fall, okay? And we're talking primarily about fall grazing. So with our winter wheat, our seed corn production, and to some extent corn silage, we have the capability to produce some substantial amounts of forage cover crops that can add quite a bit of gain onto some cattle. One of the things that I've been specifically looking at are annual forages that have been fall planted that can produce fall forage, potentially look at utilizing those into the spring. One of the things that I found interesting, if we look at this group of spring species, and it includes oats, spring barley, and also spring triticale, compared that to cereal rye, a winter barley, and a winter triticale that were planted in the third week of August. Now, this is 1 year data in the fall of 2015 into the spring of 2016, which that fall was relatively mild. So we had quite a bit of precipitation. We had quite a bit of extended growing season. We didn't get our first frost that year until about that mid-December, as I recall. So if you look at the growth accumulation, we were still getting in the spring species on to almost the third week of December. They were continuing to accumulate growth. After the killing frost, one of the things we were interested in was looking at the deterioration in yield and also quality. Compare that to the winter species. The winter barley had pretty well reached its maximum production there by third week of November. The other three species still had a little bit of growth to do into December. So in a best case scenario in small plots, we were able to produce quite a bit of forage available for grazing. If you looked at the decline of in vitro dry matter digestibility, you did note some decline in digestibility, but I would also like to note that that in vitro digestibility was extremely high in both cases. We did see a little bit more of a decline in the spring species because they did accumulate a little bit of stem. I think there was some leaf loss there is what we were seeing with some of the decline on the spring species. Winter species appeared to be a little more consistent over time. Crude protein basically showed the same thing. Even though we had some decline, it was still adequate to supply protein to growing animals. Well, kind of in summary, the herbage mass that we were looking at for the spring species was slightly greater than the winter species. It was also more consistent for the winter species across harvest dates. It did not decline as much after growth ceased. And then this is a key point, the bottom one is although the nutritive value was high for both groups, it was greater for the winter species than the spring species, and it remained high over the entire winter. So I do think from this there is some potential to maybe not graze during the fall, but allow these cover crops to grow during the fall and then graze them over the winter months, because we still have adequate forage quality available at that time. Looking at some annual cool season grasses following soybean, this is a comparison of wheat, cereal rye, and triticale that was conducted out of Rob Mitchell's research group. And quickly look at the three-year forage yield. Cereal rye had the greatest forage yield, averaged over 3 years. However, it also had the lowest IVDMD, although you might argue 69% was still pretty high IVDMD. However, when we look at the animal gains, one of the things that we note is that triticale had both the highest average daily gain and also the greatest total beef gain per acre. Cereal rye was among the lowest. So the comparison, some of the key points to this is we look at spring grazing of the small grains following soybean. One of the things that's important to note is at least during this three-year study, these were extremely small windows of opportunity that we had for grazing. 1 year we had only 17 days of grazing. The greatest number of days was 32 days of grazing. If you look at those two pictures there on the left, that'll show some of the issues that we have with grazing these small grains is that cereal rye on the bottom matures so much more quickly than the others. It can cause some issues with some of the production. I think we were seeing that in some of the in some of that data. When we look at the economics of this, the big thing to look at is that far right column over there. Triticale had the greatest mean net return, a little over $62 per kilogram per hectare per year. Cereal rye actually lost money at negative 28, almost negative $29 per kilogram per hectare per year. So there's going to be quite a bit of difference in a lot of these small grains, I think. And so this is one of the issues that we still need to continue to evaluate, which one of these are going to be the most profitable over the long run. So kind of to summarize some information that we talked about, some that we didn't talk about, I think if we look at grazing capacity potential from cropland, if we look at corn, especially the residue in combination with the distillers grains, we've got the potential there for around 200 kilograms per hectare of additional beef per year. Grazed forage cover crops following soybean, corn, silage, and wheat. Mayor Drenowski has data on the corn, silage, and wheat that I didn't present, but they're pretty similar to the soybean data. I think the difference is that the wheat and corn silage were grazed during the winter, where that soybean was a late spring grazing. Improved perennial pastures. There's a lot of interest, and I hit on this a little bit earlier when I was talking about some of the marginal lands. Improved perennial pastures, I think they may fit pretty well back into some of those marginal crop acres. Also short rotation crops in addition to long rotation crops. There's not a lot of economic data out there, although the one that fits in with the Midwest is a study that Mitchell conducted on marginal cropland, where the comparison was to corn and beef cattle grazing big blue stem. 3-year net mean return for beef was $71 per acre greater than corn. In 2 out of the 3 years, grazing big blue stem was greater than corn, and corn had a greater net yield or a greater net return in 1 year. But overall, over the 3 years, big blue stem, grazing big blue stem with beef cattle outperformed corn production. Cool season grass production in the Nebraska sand hills. This is some fairly it's old data, but it's still good data. This was 1995 data, where Denny Bauer had looked at grazing some different cool season perennial grasses on marginal cropland in the sand hills. I highlighted Lincoln smooth brome grass, which has long been the standard for smooth brome grass. Oahe intermediate wheat grass, which has been the standard intermediate wheat grass. Both of those produce the highest average daily gains and also the highest total beef gain per acre. Again, they were similar to what the production from the soybean was on the previous slide, and then also some of the grazing corn residue with distillers grains. Cool season perennial grasses, if we look at including some of those, you know, this is not a sales pitch, but it does demonstrate a couple of pretty key points. If you look at the Oahe intermediate wheat grass and also Slate intermediate wheat grass, which are older varieties, and compare those to Manska and Beefmaker, which are newer varieties, one of the things you can note is that there is some improvements in forage yield and also in vitro dry matter digestibility. The same holds true also for 2-year average daily gain in grazing trials and also the total beef gain per acre. Newell smooth brome grass is another one that was developed with a higher yield that also has some improved animal performance and also total beef gain per acre over Lincoln, which is the standard. So if we look at moving into rehabilitating some of these marginal crop lands with perennial grasses and also potentially including some of these perennial grasses as short-term rotation crops or long-term rotation crops, especially if we're interested in grazing beef cattle, we do have some cultivars that are going to be substantially better than some of the older ones that can hopefully improve that beef production a little further. Warm season perennial grasses, data shows the same thing. The top two big blue stem are older varieties. The bottom two are newer ones. The same for the Indian grass, the same pattern holds true. Talk a little bit about a year-round model grazing system, and this was one of the first things that I thought about when I had arrived back in Lincoln in 2014 and had visited with Rob Mitchell, and one of the things that we thought was, okay, can we do something from a year-round grazing standpoint for the Corn Belt region? And we thought probably we stood a pretty good chance looking at Newell smooth brome grass that could be grazed during the spring and also the fall, including Liberty switchgrass, which is a bioenergy switchgrass, but it may have some grazing potential. Shawnee switchgrass is an improved variety that can be grazed during the summer, looking at grazing corn residue during the winter as a standard practice, and then had soybean in there, grazing stubble during the fall, and then look at grazing the forage cover crops in during the spring. So kind of in theory, in our mind, this was something that would at least have the potential, if not to provide year-round grazing, to come pretty close to providing the maximum number of grazing days that would be allowed. Some of the 2016 results, all the forages were harvested that year as hay. They ranged anywhere from slightly over 2 tons per acre up to near 3 tons per acre. Corn yield was around 130 bushels. Corn stover yield was around 3/4 of a ton per acre. We look at the 2017 results. We actually did some grazing this year on that study. Smooth brome grass, total beef gain per acre was a little over 84, or around 84 pounds an acre. That returned around $50 per acre. Grazing Shawnee switchgrass and 7 days grazing on the Liberty. Same cattle gained 125 pounds per acre for a net return of almost $70, $68 per acre. Smooth brome grass was grazed in the spring. We haven't got that data yet. Corn grain yield I got this morning while I was here during the first talk, and if I can remember the number, that was 158 bushels per acre this year. So we've kind of moving that direction towards getting some long-term information on some of these systems. Triticale cover crop I didn't talk about on the previous slide. It was planted last year, was dry in the spring, so we didn't have a lot of production for grazing. So there is some risk involved with these cover crops. They're not automatic, okay? Our triticale cover crop this year was planted last week, okay? So I've covered an awful lot of ground. This is a nice little picture that has taken some time for several folks to talk about and put together. But it covers a lot of the things that we've talked about. One of the things that we have not talked about is that bottom rectangle that's right in the middle that in this slide is titled Environmental Services. Okay, I've heard the word sustainability used this morning. I've heard the word maybe stewardship is another one. And I don't know what the right term is, but when we're interested in improving our soil, water, and air, whatever term you use, that's where we're all trying to move with this, is look at improving these environmental services or ecosystem services. Final thoughts, at least what we know, or at least what we think we know. We've got a fair idea of some of the forage production, some of the grazing value of some of these forage cover crops. Key point to note is that the windows of opportunity in all examples are extremely narrow windows, often no more than 60 days. Livestock production, we do have an idea of some of the beef gains for grazing some of the cropland from fall grazing after wheat and corn silage, and also beginning to get some information on some of the spring grazing. Perennial grasses are woefully underutilized. Final thoughts that I have, and I'll finish up with this, is what we don't know, or at least what we haven't figured out. I'd like to think we haven't figured it out yet. Timeliness, trade-offs, and transition. And I think a lot of those have been talked about already today. The other thing we haven't figured out, and this gets back to that first slide, those couple of sentences in there that I'd taken out of that publication from Schultz and Tracy. You know, when we look at this systems level management, this is a complicated critter, man. It's a lot of fun, but it is overly complicated. okay? The trade-offs, I think, may be the biggest one, but probably more important. The first things that we need to get a handle of are this productivity of these systems, the sustainability of these systems, and then also the economic achievability of these systems. And with that, I'll finish.